your prime.
What about my prime, Nick?
Welcome to Properly Howard, a podcast that reviews classic films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at the romantic comedy Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray as a weatherman who is forced to relive the same day over and over again. Groundhog Day explores the existential crisis of balancing the mundanity of life and white people jazz. With me to discuss this, as always, is Dr. Anthony LaDon. I mean, and you figure in Punxsutawney, he's the blackest guy there, right?
There's the bartender, you know, that
who's just is nonplussed by everything.
He really has that kind of twinkle in his eye that it's like, here, I'm going to make this drink for you, and then I got to go teach a white kid how to play golf. Steve, if I wanted to torture you for eternity, what song would I wake you up to every day? And specifically, what part of the song?
Any part of the Friends theme would work. I don't need that.
For me, it's Robert Palmer, Simply Irresistible.
How about, I'll do you one worse. Tom Cruise singing over Addicted to Love by Robert Palmer.
Yeah, but at least, there's a layer of humor to that.
I mean, he's just so tonally off for a song that is so simplistic. How? How in the world?
I forgot that we covered that. That was sort of a moment in time. Yeah. A lot of ZZ Top songs would be torture.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not a big fan of just the repetition of ZZ Top. I could watch them all day long.
Twirling fuzzy guitars with long beards, you like that?
Yeah, they're endlessly fascinating to watch.
Yeah, so you almost require a viewing, not a listening.
Exactly. Whereas with Robert Palmer, if I'm watching the video, it makes it worse.
Right.
The video actually does match the song in this case.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a very specific time, too. Simply Irresistible and Addicted to Love. You know, he beat out Peter Gabriel for Male Artist of the Year then because of that.
You know what? I take it back. Addicted to Love is worse than Simply Irresistible. All right. So this movie tortures Bill Murray with Sonny and Cher. I Got You, Babe. And I think you could probably do it with any song. Even if I took your favorite song and I played it for you 10,000 times, starting in the same spot every time, you would hate it by the end, right? So
yeah, it becomes a curse, right? I mean, and that's what I really like about like how the song signals, here we go again, right? I mean, it's a really like clever that not just do like an alarm clock sound or also FM radio.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Why that song? Why I Got You, Babe by Sonny and Cher?
Well, it's sort of, it's kind of innocuous, right?
Do you think it's thematic? It's like just to kind of rub it in that no one will ever know you well enough. You're endlessly alone. And so this song just rubs it in.
Yeah, just by its very nature of being a duet, suggests companionship.
And it's just so earnest, and Bill Murray is so cynical, and he's got no reason not to be cynical.
It's sweet, it's simple.
Yeah.
It's a romantic comedy of songs.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, those are simpler times, man. Sonny and Cher. There was a time in American history where Sonny and Cher made sense. Just think about that for a minute.
Yeah. And that, but not like it wasn't, I mean, these are like tumultuous times, right? Late 60s.
They had their own show.
I mean,
America was just like, yeah, we're fine with this. We're totally on board with
a couple of mismatched, weird looking hippies.
Maybe that was it. It's like, well, they're hippies. They don't make sense anyway. So
yeah, like, why not? We're not doing that now, right? As a response to sort of like maybe tumultuous times in our own society, we just like hand the keys over to like some Gen Z skibbity toilet hour or something like that.
So, Steve, I'm just going to go ahead and lay all my cards on the table. I've never done this before. I'm going to call this a properly Howard movie. And I'm going to say it's by far the best properly Howard movie ever.
Wow.
Yeah. It's in my top 10.
You're saying this is peak Howard and it's not Howard.
It's peak Howard. It's not Howard. It's sort of the movie that would have made Howard irrelevant for the way we're using him.
Gotcha.
So if that is confusing, let me tell you, I'm confused by this too. It is a properly Howard movie for sure, right? Well, I haven't asked you. I'll ask you later. It is a properly Howard movie for sure. It is in my top 10, which means it of all the movies ever made, this is one of the best movies in my view. And it's properly Howard. So I don't know how that all works, but I'm willing to call it the best properly Howard movie ever.
Incredible. I think I would definitely agree properly Howard, for all the good and bad reasons. And I really want to explore, this is a top 10 movie for you now.
Yeah,
cause we've talked, you and I have had conversations both on here and, off, podcast about like top 10 movies and how those have changed over the years. Has Groundhog Day been a little bit more of a mainstay for you?
Always a mainstay. I feel like there's always movies that like kind of come onto the list and fall off the list. You know, Magnolia was on and fell off. Empire Strikes Back is sort of like falling down the ranks. There are movies that will never fall off. And this is a movie that has never fallen off.
Funny you say that about Empire Strikes Back, because I've sort of detached from Star Wars over the years just because of sort of maybe oversaturation.
Mm-hmm.
But just thinking about certain scenes like right now about Empire Strikes Back, like those memories taste like a baseball card chewing gum.
Which is good.
Well, which is great. Which is
because that chewing gum is not good.
No, but it is contextually important. And there's just something about.
Look, I promise you, if you popped on Empire right now, you'd be back in it. I'd enjoy it again.
I think you're right.
It'd be like, I can't believe I've deprived myself of this. This movie's a banger of a movie.
Yeah, you're probably, I mean, because there's Billy Dee Williams, for crying out loud. In a cape.
And you don't even know. You don't even know you're going to get him.
Yeah.
Take it to Cloud City.
Yeah. Truly you belong here amongst us in the clouds.
Yeah, I'm gonna also mess this podcast up by adding my one tweak. This movie definitely needed Billy Dee Williams at one point.
Just in a cape.
I want to see
Phil Connors. It's me, Needle Nose Ned. Ned Ryerson. Bing. What's that first step, Phil? It's a doozy.
So for me, this movie changed my life.
Whoa.
I feel like I lived my entire 20s wanting to be Bill Murray in this movie. Not the Bill Murray committing suicide. That didn't happen until my 40s.
You just keep watching those scenes over and over again. if only.
I wanted to be the kind of guy who, and I probably was the kind of guy for a while who would be in this scene here.
Well, I thought we were going to a costume party.
It's like I said,
I love this film. I've seen it over 100 times.
Phil!
Told you. Call me Bronco.
Sorry, Bronco.
Hi, Nancy. My old fiancé doesn't remember me.
That scene is so great because it kind of shows how weird it would be to be immortal, but it's the same day over and over again. It's like, it's not just that you're going to commit suicide 10,000 times. It's that you're going to do some weird stuff just to kind of entertain yourself. And I thought, yeah, that's the kind of person I want to be. I want to be the kind of person that dresses up like Clint Eastwood randomly, just to go to a movie. I would do stuff like that just to kind of entertain myself in my 20s. And I'm looking back on it now, I'm thinking, I was kind of an asshole. But I was having a lot of fun at the time. And I kind of feel like that was part of my 20s, was just to kind of live without those social rules. And then kind of eventually learn the lesson that Bill Murray did in this movie. You're actually not going to be happy until you are literally doing good in the world. So I kind of feel like this movie...
Chainsaw eye sculpting.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
So that's my history with this movie. What's yours?
I like the idea that, like, I think the key line for that you're speaking of, and like that also resonated with me, was I'm not gonna live by their rules anymore.
Yeah, that's where the movie. So that's where sort of the second act of the movie begins.
Right. So we're watching this in our early 20s, late teens, right? And we are appreciating.
We're 18. We're 18. Or
yeah, like we're that. Appreciating. We're appreciating a midlife crisis in advance.
Yeah.
So because there's a lot there. There's kind of we'll
call it kind of a mid eternity.
Yeah. I mean, when we first see it, it's like it's a fun movie, and then the more you watch it, the more you realize what an existential commentary it is, and how you can kind of watch his development and watch his, you know, at first it's just disbelief. He's like, "What? This can't be right," and so I'm freaking out. And then it's like, "Wait a minute. I can do whatever I want. I've been locked in a Toys R Us overnight. Like, I'm scared. I'm not with my parents. But wait a minute. I can play with all these toys and all this stuff. And I can, yeah. Oh, look, there's junk food over there." And you keep doing it and doing it. And then you get to a point where you're just like, I feel like I've done it all. You know, I've put on a Clint Eastwood outfit.
It's kind of interesting how quickly the hedonism gets boring.
Well, we don't know, right? I mean, we don't know how much time it takes.
We don't know how long, but the
movie paces pretty well. But
in terms of, yeah, the movie time, like this could, this could be a 10,000 year movie. But in terms
by the time he's in the cowboy outfit, he says, "I've seen this movie hundreds of times." Now, that isn't to say that he obviously didn't probably watch it for the first month or so of doing this. But like, that's another part of town that he's just like kind of invested in. And does he do it every single day, or does he do it every other day? Does he do it every week? You know, so like the idea that he's seen it hundreds of times is a really telling moment that you're like, dude, how long is like, that's a, how long have you been there?
Yeah. I don't get the sense that there's a HBO at his bed and breakfast.
No, there's not hot water.
So every night when he wants to wind down, he goes and sits with whatever movie this is. What movie do you think this is? Do you think it's an Eastwood movie?
I don't know. That's a good question. Does it even say?
I think it's funnier if it's not an Eastwood movie.
Right.
Every night he goes, picks up the same girl, says, "I got to go to a costume party. Just so happened that I've got this costume for you to put on." For some reason, she decides to go with him. And then he takes her to the movies.
Yeah.
This is his idea of winding down at night. So, okay. I guess we're already there. So let's just ask the question. How long is he actually reliving the same day?
Let's guess. I've seen a few theories. IFC calculated 33 years.
So that's interesting. That I think when Ramis was first interviewed, when it came out, he said about 10 years. But then with the DVD commentary, he said, it'd probably be more like 30 years. So that would work. 30 years. Now,
I think how does that shape your viewing of the movie when you hear that? Because I didn't really think about that until later. And then when I heard about it, I was just like, whoa, that's interesting. Like, I mean, it's interesting in the sense that, like, it's easy to sit there and sort of, and I want to do this as we go along and sort of pick apart his behavior, both savory and unsavory, and how he kind of wraps up and what that would mean. You know, and like, cause I think there's some things about, from a romantic comedy perspective, that are kind of problematic. But when you know that this guy's been trapped in this place for, you know, 33 years, you get a sense of like, I'm going to start forgiving a certain amount of behavior, perhaps.
Okay, if it's 33 years, it might as well be 10,000 years. Because
right. It's the same day.
You have no way to keep track of time.
Right.
It's not like he can chisel a little tally mark on the wall.
Yeah, because they'll go away for sure. There's nothing you can do about it.
There's nothing you can do about that. So if it's 30 years, does he know how long it is? Has he completely lost track of
You'd have to just remember, right? You'd have to be like, okay, I'm on day 47. After like how many of those days like would you just like forget to or not think about?
How many
it,
of those days did he put a toaster in a bathtub?
Right.
And do those count? Right. I don't know.
Well, think about that too. Yes, that's a great point. Right. Like if you wake up in the morning and just kill yourself,
does that count as a day?
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think if he heard Sonny and Cher, it counts as a day. And it doesn't matter how long the day is because time is totally meaningless at that point.
Right. Yeah, how many days would that be the first thing you do is just cut yourself? It's crazy.
It's kind of nuts. All right, so I wrote down the stages of his interests. Now, in terms of the pacing of a movie, this does not follow any rules that I can think of. It feels like we're about 18 minutes in before you even wonder like, oh, wait a second. This might be a sci-fi. You know, watching this for the first time, you probably know what you're getting into going in. But it's 18 minutes in of a movie that's a little bit over 90 minutes before they actually replay the second day. All right, 18 minutes in, he realizes that he's been cursed. Kind of like a vampire. Like I think the writer for this film said that he got the idea after reading the book Interview with a Vampire.
Right.
So it's an interesting sort of take on the vampire immortality thing. Okay, so here's the things he's interested in. He wants to get out of Punxsutawney. Then he just wants to get laid. And he has this whole sort of hedonistic thing that doesn't really last very long. And then he starts testing the limits of like, what could I actually get away with? And then he decides the only thing that's going to entertain me is to try to trick Rita into loving me. And at that point, I think he's probably the most immoral.
Right.
Even more than sort of the sexual harassment stuff at the beginning. He has decided he's going to make her his project. And, yeah, you know, she kind of calls it out. Yes.
Gathering information.
Totally manipulating. And he realizes that he's never going to be able to do it. And I think he's realizing like, I'm going to relive this over and over again. And she's never going to fall for me. And that's when he starts killing himself. Then he starts to make Pop his project. I'm going to save Pop. And he realizes he can't do that. And that's when I think he makes the moral shift. And so then he decides, I'm going to try to make every day in Punxsutawney better than the last. And I really think at that point he starts caring for Punxsutawney and not just how everyone perceives him.
Right.
And that's when he finally gets to the last stage, and that is ice sculpture.
Right.
And that is the, that's the moral of the story. Is you can be a complete dick, but if you can learn to ice sculpt, people will love you.
I'm glad we actually kind of had an inadvertent reference to Cocktail in the beginning of this, because two very different points of view on sculpting in those two movies. Whereas in Cocktail, I mean, sculptors were clearly the bad people, and then there was just any opportunity to ruin sculptures. Because, I mean, hell, you can make the argument that a glass liquor bottle is also a sculpture of sorts, and it's used ultimately to kill Coughlin at the end. So I think one of the things of watching this, you know, with Heather, that she kind of gets like her hackles, not hackles, but like that she finds problematic, and I do too. But like looking at it again, you know, this most recent time. Because I want to keep a critical eye on this thing, is sort of this accelerated love from an Andy McDowell character perspective.
This movie absolutely makes no sense from her perspective, right?
Totally. And I think that there's something about Bill Murray's final form. His speech is different. The way he talks is different. He kind of comes off like, you know, just like, oh, shucks. But it's like, it feels a little manufactured. But there's also this sense of like, if this is like 33 years in, he doesn't know this is the last day either. You know, so we don't know if this is another, like he's trying this on for size. You know what I mean? It's like, there's a certain element of it. Like, how often has he been doing the piano so well at the party? And was that his first time giving WrestleMania tickets? And maybe this time he put a little more attention on Rita than he did like the time before, or you know what I mean? Maybe
I've got a perspective on this. What does Heather think? I want to know first for what Heather
she
think.
Loves the movie. But like, and if I was going to, if for, since we're talking tweaks, I think the biggest tweak for me is when he says to her, to Rita, about like, he's all, I know that I'm happy now. And then he says, because I love you. Scrap the because I love you, because that would have, I don't see how she would just be like, okay. You know what I mean? It's like, I think if it's just happy now, that's actually a really nice way to end that. And I think as soon as he says, because I love you, I just don't see how she could be like, okay. I mean, yeah, she's surprised by all those things, but that's like 24 hours from the last time she saw him. Where he
yeah,
was
it makes no sense
dick.
From her perspective. For sure, it makes zero sense from her perspective.
But I have no problem to some degree of her being like, whoa, this is, I had no idea this side of him. Maybe the interactions I've had with him, maybe that's not the real him. Maybe I caught him in a bad day, because this is a lot. Like, there's so much here that suggests this guy is actually much more interesting and sweet and all those things. Like I totally could see someone being like, I want to get to know this person a little bit more. But if that person said, I love you, that kind of undercuts it to me. So I think that to me is the biggest tweak I would make, is remove that line, because we've already had a moment where he says, I love you. And she's like, you don't even know me.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it would work this day. You know what
I'm
going
to tell because... you. I'm going to tell you why it works. Because he actually does love her. He didn't love her before. He thought he did. Really, she is a project for him. At some point in this 30-year journey, he stopped trying to have sex with her. I think he just feels like that's not going to happen. Moreover, I don't think I want to do this to this person, because I would just be manipulating this person. But somewhere along the way, he authentically falls in love with her.
Well, what are his options?
And it doesn't really happen. Oh, I don't know. I think Bronco Girl is an option for me, at least.
Sure, sure.
I do think that there's something about he's changed. He's no longer phallocentric, this guy. He actually cares about Punxsutawney. He might feel like a god in the way that you would if you were in this situation, but not like I'm better than everyone. It's just like, in order to give my life any meaning at all, I have to become a different person, morally speaking. And he's become a different person. He's not the same person who said I love you before. Moreover, he's authentically expressing something like it's earnestly true in his soul. And she sees that.
She sees it from a guy that she's known for 24 hours.
Like I said, it doesn't make sense from her perspective, but think about it from his perspective. He's thinking, I don't really care what the response is. She might slap my face again. But in this moment, I have to say this thing to this person no matter the consequence. And I think that there's something authentic about that, that for whatever reason, it works. A one in a million shot, it happens to work this time.
Interesting. Yeah, from a romantic comedy perspective, again, it is a little bit...
I think most romantic comedies are phallocentric. And I think, you know, Andy McDowell's perspective is really not considered very well in this movie.
No.
But as an audience member... you desperately want her to love him back because of Ray Charles. I'm telling you that this song is so good that it actually fools you into thinking that she could fall for him.
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello, and I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell. You think you know me well, but you don't know me.
I'm telling you, Steve, that song is so good. It will fool you into thinking that Andy McDowell could fall for Bill Murray in this movie. I think it's a top 10 love song of all time. This may be the best needle drop of in any movie. It's just an all-time banger. I love this song so much. And it's in a movie with some horseshit songs.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. All the other songs in the movie so horrible. So then when that drops, you're thinking, oh, my God, I think I'm in love with Bill Murray.
If you told me that John Tesh did the soundtrack, I'd have believed you.
I think Harold Ramis actually co-wrote the Weatherman song.
Oof.
It's really bad.
Oof. That is, so this is a testament to how good this movie is, that its first impression on you is the Weatherman song, and you still watch it. I turned that thing on last night, and I was like, ah, man, I forget.
It's almost genius, and I'll tell you why. And I don't think Ramis actually thinks that it's a good... he's making good choices musically, but the fact that it's so bad almost matches the personality of Bill Murray early on. And then when he finally shifts, it's Ray Charles. And it's like, in contrast to the horrible music we experienced earlier in this movie, Ray Charles feels like I'm in heaven. And it's enough. It's enough for me to be like, all right, I'm on board.
That's fair. I mean, he does have his turn, but he still plays the song he plays during the banquet scene. So on the piano.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say my favorite trope.
Oh yeah,
it's white guy wearing Ray Charles glasses playing jazz,
playing white people jazz.
And I will say this: I'm not a fan of the saxophone, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would say like 99% of the time, I hate the saxophone. And usually the 1% involves Huey Lewis in the News. And when I think of the saxophone just sort of as a concept, it's the music that is played during that scene. For me, the saxophone is what the lead guitarist's ponytail hair is to your sensibilities.
Gotcha. Okay, so that makes, yeah, so that it was, so if you and I were trapped in Groundhog Day, we would do everything we could to avoid that band.
Do you, all right, I'm going to let you go back to the original conversation, which was, do we believe that Andy McDowell actually would fall for this guy?
Right, so I don't have a problem, you know, with, like I said, if you look at it from her perspective, she was dealing with him the day before the write-up or whatever, and she's been warned he's a pain and all of that, right? So they don't really have much of a relationship prior to that. And he sort of lives up to that being a pain prima donna when they first get there. Because, like, the day before, you know, she has to get him his hotel or his Airbnb or bed and breakfast and everything. And so, like, he's a pain when they get there. But then the next day they do their shoot and he's, you know, 100% locked in as this, not only a great, you know, weatherman, but he's inspiring people with his speech. And so it's like, she's like taken aback. That's different. And then her experiences throughout the day is all of this stuff that he's known for, that he's, because he does all that stuff without her, which I think is really important for this scene, right?
Like, well, and she's hearing other people sing his praises. I think number one, it's really important to call out that she sees him do the best weatherman bit she's probably seen anyone ever do, and I believe that she's affected by that. She earnestly cares about her job. She thinks it's important. She, you know, her career doesn't sort of encapsulate her, but it's important to her. And so to see him actually care about the things she cares about, I think she sees him in a new way.
And I do think she would be genuinely curious in that evening, hearing about all these like tales of things that he's done. I think I would be curious to be like, I got to know a little bit more about this person.
Moreover, he's such a prick to her. The second and third day, like literally sexually harassing her in one of these scenes, but right. She has no memory of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I think he's almost become an asexual being at this point in the movie. You know, by the time he sort of delivers the Chekhov speech in front of the groundhog. she didn't experience any of that. And I think if you watch one of the early scenes, like his statement, like, people like blood sausage, people are morons. You look at her face, she actually thinks that's a funny joke. So there's something, she's not just the Pollyanna-ish poetry loving girl. I think that she does appreciate him on some level.
She drinks sweet vermouth on the rocks with a twist. She's a monster.
That's a great scene when he actually takes a sip.
Oh, when he takes a sip, I know exactly what that tastes like. I've never ordered that, but I know exactly what it would taste like. And that is insane. That's an insane drink order.
So let's go back to what you're saying. From her perspective, she knows him as sort of this cynical guy who's self-involved, but she doesn't know him really that well. And then the next day, she realizes, holy shit, this guy's talented. And he actually moved me with a Groundhog Day speech. That's impressive. And then he kind of ignores her. Right? And then,
right,
you know, he says
he had errands to run.
He has errands to run. And then she's realizing he's like the prince of Punxsutawney. Like, who is this guy? So all of that to say is that she doesn't know him at all, right? But from all the accounts, he's like the perfect man, but he still looks like Bill Murray. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that would explain why he's single.
So I totally buy your, and I think that for most of the last 20 years of watching this movie, I agreed with you. Like, there's no way she falls for him. And it makes no sense as a romantic comedy. It almost makes more sense as sort of like a Buddhist treatment of loss of ego more than a romantic comedy.
Right.
But love is weird, dude. And if you catch the right person at the right moment, people will do crazy, crazy shit.
Well, and it is designed as a romantic comedy first. And I'm doing a little research. I'm sure you have too. Similar to our last film. Be very careful when I say similar to our last film, because Memoirs of an Invisible Man is not on this level. But similar to the last film, you have a differing of opinions on how the movie's tone should be from the director and the actor. Because Bill Murray wants more philosophical. Bill Murray wants to explore a little bit more of the existential dread that goes along with it. And Ramis wants to make a romantic comedy. And so they're at odds a lot. And this is the movie that kind of killed their friendship.
Yeah, after this movie, they don't talk for 21 years.
Yeah. And like, he'd show up late to the set. He would be a pain. I guess he was going through a divorce. So that sort of altered his mood and probably changed his desire.
For Murray, not Ramis.
Murray, yeah. For like wanting to do something like upbeat and romantic and whimsical. So, and I know that they brought in the Ruben to sort of redoctor the script. And so I know Murray and him worked together, and he was kind of frustrating for Ruben. And so, but anyway, you essentially Ramis wins out, and there are some elements that, there's dark elements for sure in this, but they don't go too far. And I guess the original ending was,
we do see him commit suicide three times.
Right. Exactly. That's dark.
Connected to the next movie we're going to watch, by the way.
Exactly. So there was, I guess the alternate ending was he expresses his love to Rita after the spell is broken.
Which would make more sense.
And then she recoils.
Yeah, which makes more
sense. And it puts her in a time loop.
Interesting.
Now that's a weird ending.
It's a weird ending. I like it. And I do like it better. The ending of this movie never really made sense to me, but continue.
It is an ad lib line that he does that I think helps the movie, where at the end where he goes, "Let's live here." He ad libs right afterwards, "Let's rent to start." And I think that that's a really key moment.
I wondered if it was an ad lib. I think he saved the scene with that. Let's live here. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was me, it'd be like, let's go to Hawaii for a while.
Right. And that's why I think the let's rent to start was like I liked it because it kind of gave this like a euphoric, oh my God, I can't believe this is finally happening. You know, I love this place. Like, no, actually, you know what? Maybe a brick. You know, so I think that's a really simple ad lib that helps move the rest of, you know, the ever after a little bit.
Well, what it does though is it also kind of brings you back to reality. Like, this is sort of a fantasy world, and all of a sudden it's like, we'll rent to start is something that you would just, it's sort of something mundane you would just say to someone that, there's nothing fantasy land about let's rent to start.
The idea of renting versus buying no longer says you're not going to live by their rules anymore.
Well, also, I mean, she might not like him. Like,
right.
Like if he doesn't know exactly what's going to happen with this entire town all day long, he might not be a prince.
Right. And if you go, let's say you go back to New York, it's like, there's just not a lot of chainsaw ice sculpting opportunities. So like, that's a big... That's a big bonus for why they're together, you know. And it's like
the chainsaws really made this relationship. No, you're right. The ending of this movie is a problem. The Andy McDowell perspective on him is a problem. For some reason, I've just resolved to overlook those things.
And I think that's that's where most people I talk to are. Like, it's like, yeah, I know, but everything about this is so, it's almost perfect, right? I mean, there is, if you allow it to follow the rules of, say, a holiday movie, like a Christmas movie, mm-hmm. there's a lot of things you forgive in a Christmas movie, because there are tropes and elements of that you just know are going to be part of it, right? You're supposed to feel good. Mm-hmm. You just are. You're just the way it works. And it's supposed to be inexplicable, and that's fine. And I think part of the inexplicability of this is one of the things that makes it special, is you don't know why any of this happened. It just does. And I know the studio was really adamant that they show why this is, because like they could not get their heads around it. They're like, but why? And some people even turned down the role because they're like, well, I don't understand why this is happening. Like, it's an interesting thing that matters. You know, I've never considered, well, I wonder why. It's never even crossed my mind, because I don't care. That's not the point. Like, I guess they even had like a couple of scenes they were going to do where it was like, an invention went haywire, sort of like Memoirs of an Invisible Man, or that he got cursed by a former lover. And they told the studio that they were going to shoot those scenes. And they said, we're going to plan to shoot those last, so when we run out of time, we just don't do it.
Interesting.
Which is really interesting.
That's just genius.
I mean, how much worse is this movie if there's a reason? And then if there's a reason, you know what they have to do? Undo it. And that becomes the mission. If you have no reason for it,
well,
then the mission is just self-realization. And,
let me ask you this.
This Buddhist growth that you kind of...
Yeah. Let me suggest this to you. I think for our generation, this is our It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, I would agree.
So this is a Wonderful Life. It's not like an experiment that goes haywire. It's sort of... this is all kind of fantasy land. Angel gets his wings situation. If you were gonna if you wanted to tell me how this movie was done, could you involve an angel that's sort of the prologue and the epilogue of the movie? I think it's a worse movie, but it's better to do it that way than to do it as a sci-fi thing.
Yeah.
Is this movie a sci-fi?
I was gonna ask that question too. It somewhat feels like it, right? I mean, and there's a lot of things that would, it's almost like a religious sci-fi to some degree, right? Like maybe like almost an Eastern philosophical sci-fi, for lack of a better term. Because it's, because there is, when you're dealing with a time loop, I immediately start thinking science fiction, right?
Science fiction, and also you're kind of playing out the consequences of like, well, what if this happened? And then you want to explore all of the ramifications for this freak occurrence. That's a very sci-fi thing to do.
Right. And you know, there could have been days where, I don't know if you could do off-track betting in Punxsutawney or whatever, but like he would know these types of, like if he knows the Jeopardy thing, things of that nature, it's like, could you set yourself up for, if I ever get out of this, I could be rich because of it.
It's interesting that this is all in a small town. And... there's somewhat,
and the phones are down.
Yeah. So he's very, it's all very contained. It's like he's living in a snow globe in a lot of ways. It's like if you could be omnipotent, but you have to live in a snow globe. That's kind of what this movie is.
Right. I wonder if there's any theories that when he gets hit in the back of the head with the shovel when he's on the phone, that begins this whole thing. And that's because if he gets hit in the head, the next scene is him drinking and he like does this thing where like he kind of holds the middle of the bridge of his nose and kind of makes it like he's got a migraine kind of going on. And then the next thing you know, he's in a coma the whole time.
I think you're right in that the fact that they don't explain the time loop makes it a better movie, because I think a worse movie is he kind of wakes up from a coma. Chris Elliott and Andy McDowell standing over him saying, you really were out for a full week or something like that.
Right.
And then because of his little experience, which may or may not be real, he's a better man. It's just not a very good movie that way.
No.
It's better than.
No, I like it that never it's real. Explained. And I'm sure there's moments in his 33 years where he's like trying to find literature on this, right? But the movie didn't waste any of the time with that. I mean, that might have been a decent scene where he tries to figure out something and then it's just nothing.
I like that the resources are so limited. It's like,
right. Yeah,
there's one psychiatrist in town. His office looks like his mom decorated it for him.
Right.
I love that character. I think that this... All right, the other character that I absolutely love is Doris. This is the scene where he explains his predicament. And if you just rewatch it and look at what the waitress's facial expressions are, it just makes the scene so much better.
I'm sorry? What was that again?
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god. I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck?
You folks ready to order?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender. I am an immortal.
Special today is blueberry waffles.
This movie has so many fantastic supporting actors. The supporting actors in this film are so good. Her facial expressions during that scene are absolutely brilliant. And there's like half a dozen characters like this that they kind of feel like bit parts, but they come back and they will have multiple scenes where they get to kind of play a scene a little bit differently. So they're actually a much bigger part of the movie that you would initially give them credit for.
Well, and Ramis does a really good job of doing that. I think he does a great job of building these people like they have to do the same. They have to be in the same day. So he kind of grounds them and has them centered in this same day for them. But they're authentically reacting to all of these things. And there are so many elements of this movie. It's like, how can you have a movie where your comedic lead, it has so much gravitas, and he does in this movie. Yet also the scenes are being stolen around him left and right.
Tobolowsky. Oh my gosh. Look, I love Bill Murray, but Tobolowsky steals every scene that he's in.
Ned Ryerson.
Bing.
Bing. So did you turn pro with that belly button thing, Ned? Or
no, Phil, I sell insurance.
What a shock.
Do you have life insurance? Because if you do, you could always use a little more. Am I right or am I right or am I right? Right.
He's just amazing. Amazing in this film.
The funniest thing he says in there, in my opinion, again, I'm watching this 1,000 times, he goes, did you go pro with that belly button thing? He goes, no. And then he goes into the next thing. Like, he doesn't laugh it off. He says, no, like, no, I got something even better for you. I mean, the way it's such a value added response to a ridiculous question. And it really helps you even understand this character even further.
And total lack of self-awareness, which you would think, hey, he's probably a pretty good life insurance salesman.
It's all a big crapshoot, anywho. So, I mean,
and every single time he comes back, I just look forward to it every time.
It's a career-defining performance. You know, I mean, he will always be this forever. And which, you know, people maybe don't want that. But, you know, at the same time, it's like not everybody gets that. And there is just the two drunks are great.
Okay. I think that they're fantastic. It's Gus and Ralph. And for whatever reason, they give Gus two of the most important lines in the entire film. They give him sort of that stupid half glass, full glass, half empty, you know, line, which kind of launches him on phase two of his journey. He's fully drunk at that point. And then they also give him the identity reveal where he says, hey, your name's Phil. Just like the groundhog, which is right. A major theme in this movie.
Yeah.
He is Phil. They are living parallel lives. It's like one of them is the spirit animal for the other. You know, they're both basically weathermen. They're both looking down the barrel of forever winter.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when he commits suicide, he decides he's got to kill the groundhog too.
Thinking that some almost feels like it's like a totem of some sort, right?
Exactly. Anyway, Gus gets that line too.
we never see, and they're wise to not. Like, what happened? I'm sure he tries to stay awake through 6 o'clock to see what happens.
Of course, that would be at least one of the methods that he tries, right?
Right.
I do think you get the sense that that's what happened when he goes to jail.
Yeah, that he stays awake and then it just flips and he was in bed as soon as it flips to six.
I mean, at least that's what the viewer sees. The viewer sees that he's behind bars, he's upright, and then who knows? The next thing that happens is he wakes up. So that's how I interpret that scene anyway. All right, so I have told you my favorite trope. What's your favorite trope?
I don't even know how tropey it is, because it feels like maybe it only exists in this type of film. But like, I love when he's doing the pacing of the robbery.
Yeah,
and maybe that's just a scene I like, and maybe I've seen this so many times that it feels like a trope. But like, maybe Groundhog Day has sort of like helped create certain tropes. But like that sequence where like when it's almost like any kind of heist when someone predicts something, like if mm-hmm. you know, I think like even in Hudson Hawk, right? They do it to singing, like when there's almost a dance to a heist type thing. I don't know why that tickles me.
Also, like the predicting of what's going to happen. Like you watching, like I think Ocean's 11, for instance, is like you've cased the joint so well that you are predicting everyone's movement because everyone's sort of living their own repetitious lives. Did you recognize the young married couple? Did you recognize
I recognize Michael Shannon.
Michael Shannon. It wasn't until this morning when I rewatched it this morning, I was like, is that Michael Shannon?
That's his debut.
Michael Shannon.
And I guess Bill Murray was rude to him on set and Harold Ramis made him apologize in public.
So Zod got the idea for being Zod going to WrestleMania.
Yeah, apparently so.
Zod went to WrestleMania, saw Zeus face Hulk Hogan, thought, this is not a bad gig. I think I'm going to be Zod. This was my, I don't know how many times I've seen this movie. This was the first time I recognized Michael Shannon. I love that they are so excited about going to WrestleMania.
Yeah, that's really, like, it's a very authentic scene.
They're getting married. They're going to honeymoon in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
And they get to see WrestleMania.
Yeah, a lot of little elements like that are really interesting. Like some of the things I was reading, like he would prevent things in the original drafts. Like he would prevent the fish truck from being able to arrive so that somebody wouldn't choke on it because they wouldn't have had fish that night. Like it's just, and this is way better, I think. I think just this sort of like the quick, he's got to go catch a kid. He's got to go save this perfect jokey. He's got to fix a tire and all of these things.
I'm glad that you mentioned the catch a kid thing because I feel like Bill Murray authentically plays a guy who's gone through tremendous moral development, but he still has the same sense of humor.
Right. Like, yeah. So he hasn't lost.
Believably. Yes, exactly. Believably, this is the same person. He's gonna do a full-on sprint to catch a kid in a way that he thinks matters. Because I think you could view this as, well, this is just going to happen every day. Like, why does this matter? The only person that really matters for is him. He cares enough to do it. And yet he's still a little bit miffed that the kids never said thank you. And yeah. I think it's just a really smart way to create continuity in the character while also showing moral development.
Right. And Bill Murray does such a good job of being all these versions of himself. And again, knowing the time frame really helps to be able to sit there and say, well, yeah, I could see you could change. And like, he's had an opportunity to be the worst versions of himself, and who knows how bad those worst versions of himself were. You know what I mean?
Like, so it's not going to surprise you that this is my favorite Bill Murray movie. Where does this rank for you in Bill Murray performances? Because he gets a lot of, he gets a lot of opportunity to do a lot of scenes in any number of ways in this movie.
This is a tough one because, I mean, there's a couple of iterations of Bill Murray, right, career-wise. I hold Ghostbusters up as, to me, it's the perfect comedy.
I mean, you got a tattoo on your arm.
Yeah, so I mean, I hold it to it's a rare feat what Ghostbusters does, and a good chunk of that is Bill Murray in it for sure. But there's a lot of other elements in there that work so that he sort of becomes more of an anchor. This is sort of, to some degree, it's like his Castaway or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's that kind of, he's so centralized.
It's interesting that you say Castaway just as a sidebar, because I think originally this movie was pitched to Tom Hanks.
Yeah, it was. And he said he wanted to go away from I think he said, everybody would know it'll work out in the end because of me.
So I like it. I'll talk about that a little later, but I want to return to the Bill Murray conversation.
This has got, I mean, it's hard to argue against this one because he's so funny. He does so many different things. I still am kind of a sucker for, in terms of just straight performance, Broken Flowers might be one of the most, and it's not from a comedic standpoint, but I think it's his most understated and one of his more intriguing performances.
I'm very partial to Rushmore. I love Rushmore.
Love Rushmore. Love Life Aquatic. I think Steve Zissou is incredible.
I think the closest he ever got to sort of critical acclaim was Lost in Translation.
Yeah.
But for me, this is it. This is the defining film of his career.
More so than Osmosis Jones.
More so than Garfield. So I for me, this movie supersedes Ghostbusters. And I couldn't imagine you saying the same.
Right. Again, I mean, it just performance for performance. Maybe I'd give it to him. This is still Ghostbusters to me is just a better comedy.
Well, and Ghostbusters for a while might have been, the most successful comedy of all time. So yeah,
it to me, it's just, I mean, and both of these do something pretty fantastic where they take a very high concept and deliver the goods. And that's super hard to do. I mean, like, usually the higher the concept, the harder it is to execute, especially if it's a comedy, I think.
So I'm glad you brought up Tom Hanks because, initially they thought, let's do Tom Hanks. And what I heard was Ramis thought, I don't know if people buy him as an asshole at the beginning of the movie. Whereas Bill Murray, I mean, he is 100% asshole in the beginning of this movie, right? And yet, this movie is very, very similar to Joe versus the Volcano. In terms of tone, in terms of sort of overall message, in terms of like, I'm going to see life differently now with this information. And I love that movie. And I think that movie is ruined if it's Bill Murray. And I think that this movie is ruined if it's Tom Hanks.
Yeah, that's fair.
Joe vs. Volcano is a much less celebrated movie. It's sort of one of my guilty pleasures, but it is one that I return to a lot.
Yeah, it's an underrated Hanks joint for sure, especially kind of in the midst of some of the other things that he was doing at the time. It feels like, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like he was still like kind of moving away from what you would consider a Joe versus the Volcano type movie. But
one of the most Bill Murray lines in this film that I look forward to every time is he's doing the piano lessons. She's like, you say this is your first lesson. And he says, yeah, but my father was a piano mover. So
that's right.
It's just delivered completely deadpan. It's sort of, this is a joke that's just for me. You know, I'm just trying to entertain myself in this weird experience. And it's a perfect Bill Murray line.
Yeah, no, it's great. He's got so many wonderful lines in it. It's especially that first day, the first day it happens. Well, what if there is no tomorrow? There wasn't today.
Yeah, that's another one.
It's a great line.
I also like the line, fastest Jack in Jefferson County. That makes me laugh every single time.
Awesome.
I like the at the very end, like the last time we see Tobolowsky, he realized that he's been burned by Andy McDowell. And he makes a little cat noise. And just walks off like he's off to his next adventure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's that. If there was ever a sequel or their spinoff, it would just be I want to follow him.
It's Andy McDowell going through the same day over and over, except for she just has to spend it all day long with Tobolowsky.
Or Tobolowsky's living every day over and over again, but he just doesn't realize it. I made another sale, same person. Crazy.
So, Steve, is this a movie better, worse, or on par with a Ron Howard movie?
Yeah, it is properly Howard. I think you're really spot on with that. It's
properly Howard, and
for all the right reasons, and even the reasons that I kind of poke at, I'm like, that also feels right.
That's right. It's properly Howard, and in my view, it's the best properly Howard movie ever made. Is there a half the battle, one to grow on moment in this film?
I had something written down earlier, and
I mean, this entire movie is kind of a moral play, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So that was where you kind of end up with like, well, don't do it. But if you get another chance, then don't do it. But I think going back to what you talked about earlier, there was a time where you admired him being in his little Clint Eastwood outfit and being kind of smarmy. I would say that don't wait for a time loop to seize the day.
I think that that's probably it. And I think, I mean, as a religious studies scholar, I feel like this, one of the most surprising things that I learned about in my education was the concept of a jubu. Are you familiar with jubus?
No. Are those all those right things that everyone's collecting now?
Yes, that's right. A jubu is a very well-known category to Jewish people. People who are ethnically Jewish and maybe even went to temple as kids, but now identify as Buddhist. And there's a lot of, sometimes you hear this as buju, but this has become a syncretism that's kind of recognized. It's kind of an important American religious category. And for a lot of reasons, but there's a lot in sort of Hebrew wisdom and Buddhist wisdom that are very compatible. And I think, I don't know a lot about Ramus, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was a little bit of that snuck into this film.
Well, he was raised Jewish, and then he adopted Buddhism with his second wife.
Exactly. So I would say that this film is almost, if you were going to teach a class on the intersection between Judaism, which would incorporate sort of Hebrew wisdom tradition, but also humor, and Buddhism, which sort of is all about loss of ego. And, you know, there is a Buddhist concept where it does take 10,000 years for your soul to be reborn. There's a lot of that in this film. For me, this film is the perfect encapsulation of the Jewish Buddhist experience. Saying that as someone who's neither Jewish nor Buddhist. So anyway, a very limited perspective mine, but I think it is used in religious studies classes to illustrate some of these points.
Interesting.
Also, like I said before, you can be a total asshole in every way possible, but if you learn to ice sculpt, people will love you. Which, man, it's hard. I mean, yeah. Not everyone can do it.
First off, wielding a chainsaw in and of itself is no mean feat.
I am so afraid of chainsaws. I've used chainsaws in the past. I know how to use chainsaws. They still scare the hell out of me.
Yeah, it's saw on a chain.
It might take 30 years of a time loop before you feel comfortable.
Well, if you knew that you could nick yourself and still be okay the next day, I mean, that's probably goes a long way. I mean, you know how many times he was spending those evenings in the hospital because of the, you know, chainsaw getting away from him.
So, Steve, we're entering our final film for Bacon Wrap. We're looking down the barrel of covering Flatliners.
Indeed.
I've never seen Flatliners.
Oh.
So this is going to be a new experience for me. I've always kind of wanted to see it. I've heard that it's, you know, it's like, it's not the best movie in the world, but it's always kind of intrigued me. Just sort of the premise of the film.
It's a Joel Schumacher joint.
Didn't plan it this way, but it just so happens that we have repetitive suicide in this film and the film that comes next.
Exactly. Funny how this works, right?
So, looking forward to that.
You give your hand to me, and then you say hello, and I can hardly speak. My heart is beating so, and anyone can tell. You think you know me well, but you don't know me.
No, you don't know me.
No, you don't know the one. Dreams of you at night, and longs to kiss your lips, and longs to hold you tight. Oh, I'm just a friend, that's all I've ever been, 'cause you don't know me.
No, you don't know me.
For I never knew art of making love, though my heart aches with love for you. Afraid and shy, I let my chance go by, a chance that you might love me too.
Love me too.
You give your hand to me, and then you say goodbye. I watch you walk away beside the lucky guy. Oh, to never, never know the one who loved you so. Well, you don't know me. Afraid and shy, I let my chance go by, a chance that you might love me too.
Love me too.
Oh, you give your hand to me, and then you say goodbye. I watch you walk away beside the lucky guy. Oh, you never, never know the one. Well, you don't know me.
You don't love me. You don't know me.
Special today's blueberry waffles.
Come on.